This week we're talking about whether people who are good at art have better eyesight.
Can a podcast be art? It can if it's more research required.
See, that's dumb, and I hate sure. it.
Science and technology!
Hello, and welcome to More Research Required, a podcast where we devise research methods for studies that no one will ever give us money to do. I'm Amy Giacomucci.
And I'm Abby Norling Ruggles.
All right, so we're going to talk about art today. Abby, what is art?
That's a bad question that I don't like. I mean, actually, like, I do have a good answer, and it's totally stolen from Scott McCloud because I love understanding comics, and it's like, one of my favorite books.
I actually was setting you up because we had a discussion about Scott McCloud like 2 days ago.
We did, because I love Scott McCloud always. I mean, I feel like that book was just very formative for me because I read it in middle school and I love comics and it taught me so much about comics. So anyway, Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud. Yeah, highly recommended.
Yeah, it was really
even
great.
Though I actually haven't read it recently, so I'm not 100% sure it holds up, but it like taught me things. Anyway. The definition of art given in that book is art is anything that's not any action that we take or anything that we make or anything that we do that's not for the purpose of survival or reproduction.
I do have a quarrel with that, which I thought of today, and I'm sorry that I set you up for this just to knock you down.
It's okay.
But my full-time job is making standardized tests.
Okay, well, but the thing is that you do that job to get money so that you can survive. And other people take the tests so they can have jobs, so they can survive. Therefore, wait, I would say it is not art for either person.
But that means that standardized tests are a direct aspect of survival?
Or well, like not a direct, obviously.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sorry, I really just twisted your words there. I just.
But no, it's like, right. There are things that you do to survive or reproduce, to further your life, to further the life of the human species, whatever. And obviously you can't totally divorce that from art because art can and should be paid, so you can do art for survival. But yeah, I think that if you're doing something purely, not as any sort of creative outlet, but purely because it will make your life better, such as doing your job to get money to have food, then like that counts as for survival.
Okay, but what about the finished product of a standardized test? That in itself does not exist as something that aids survival. It's the way that it's applied. So is art in the existence or in the application thereof?
Well, I think that art would be sort of about what the intention is in making it, possibly. I mean, it does get a little hairy because, again, you know, you can make visual art or music or whatever, you can do that for money. And so obviously then it serves a dual purpose of being a creative outlet and serving survival. But I think that, you know, with the standardized test, it exists because someone made it for money, for survival. And it exists so that people can take it to get money for survival. So in both those cases, like, there is an application that's relevant to survival. Therefore, it's not art.
Huh.
Although, I mean, you could make an argument that there is, like, an art to question writing, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if I would go that far. And again, like, Scott McCloud's definition is incredibly general. The definition that you just gave, as you mentioned earlier or alluded to earlier, does put questions of, like, patronized art. It's not called patronage anymore. It's not the Renaissance.
Well, except we have Patreon now, so it kind of is.
You're right. We came all the way around. We're full circle. We're living in the Renaissance.
I mean, it's a good
way
to go, especially because now, like, you know, with the sort of multi-person patronage model that we've got going, it's not just a rich person's game.
Yeah.
If artists can be paid, you know, by other average people who aren't rich people or corporations, like, I think that's the right direction to go.
Yeah, not all of our art has to be of wealthy people, gods, or a combination of the two, or gods right, and saints.
Exactly.
All right, so we did create this really good definition of art, and I think that we're actually not going to end up using it at all, because what we created is that art is subjective and...
Correct, yes. I mean, which of course it is. Yeah. Like, I don't even know how we're going to have this conversation, because the question that we started with was sort of predicated on the idea that, like, there might be physical skills you would have to be, quote, good at art. But how do you even figure out if someone's good at art? It's totally subjective.
Right. Maybe we should lean back on some of our prior research for this.
Okay, sure. What do you got?
All right. Well, I was looking at a lot, just a lot of reports of artists who actually had really bad vision. That was a silly rabbit hole to go down, but I did.
I looked at that a little.
Yeah, did you see that? Oh, what was his name? There was a man called Neil Harbison, I think, and I watched his TED Talk just for fun, and he's like a modern New York-based artist who's colorblind, who has a special eye that translates color into sound for him, and he refers to himself Whoa. As a cyborg artist.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's really neat. And he's like a performance artist, but his TED Talk was pretty cool. I would check it out. His name's Neil Harbison, as I said earlier. But there are a lot of artists from antiquity who became very influential, who have also had like deteriorating visions, like Degas, who is the artist who painted all of those impressionist ballerina paintings that you're probably thinking of, or if you aren't thinking of them, just look them up. They're pretty iconic.
Not hard to find. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So he had macular damage to the retina. So Manet also had cataracts that he got fixed
Monet.
Later. There are two of them.
Oh, they both did? They both had bad vision?
You know what? Oh, gosh, I have to leave now. yeah, so it was Monet. I was thinking of Manet the whole time. And this is, like, this is because there's not enough diversity in early art, because...
It's so true. Their names are one letter apart, and we're expected to, like, distinguish them between them when, like, there could be so many other people doing art that we could talk about. Like... Also, their art is, like... I mean, it's different, but it's not that different. They're both impressionists, right?
Yeah, I guess. Oh my god, this is the most pretentious laughing at you I've ever done. I'm so sorry.
I'm feeling a little judged here, because like I don't care about classical art and I still know who both Monet and Manet are.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That was like really rude of me. My family just has like prints around. My mom did a lot of art when I was growing up. She still does
That's
a lot.
Nice.
That was the most pretentious I've ever been, Abby.
That can't possibly be true. That's not like a burn on how pretentious you are. I just feel like there must have been other more pretentious things that you've done in your life.
How is that not a burn on how pretentious I am?
I don't know. I think I've done more pretentious things than that. Anyway, this is a dumb conversation to have.
Anyway, so there are basically a lot of artists had a lot of visual damage. A lot of them were impressionists.
Sorry, I would just like to point out
artists.
That I knew before I did any research on this podcast that Monet was the one with the bad vision, and you're the one who laughed at me for my lack of art knowledge.
Okay, all right, okay, listen, we can both call each other out, but an eye for an eye, because we're talking about eye problems.
That's bad. I don't like it. That's a bad joke.
That's fair. That's understandable. Anyway, so a lot of artists had visual problems. And that's all I guess I was gonna say, except for the fact that a lot of them were impressionists and abstract artists, and that in general there have been a lot of studies that have shown that thing that, for example, the human brain is more likely to quickly recognize a caricature of someone's face than the actual face. So Is there a way that worse vision actually could have enhanced one's artistic abilities in that way? Maybe is a point that I would have gotten to more eloquently if you didn't decide to ruin my whole life in front of the 8 people we know who listen to this.
Hey, I maintain that you started this.
This is going to be what ends our podcast.
Oh, no.
This is going to be in every episode from now on. We're not going to do more research studies. We're just going to
We cannot have discussions about Monet versus Manet in every podcast that we have. That would be the worst. We can't. That would be awful.
No, we just do an episode where the research is actually a criminal justice case and we investigate who was more right. And it was me.
No, you said an actually factually incorrect thing.
But I'm talking about moral correctness.
Okay, fine.
Anyway.
Yeah, no, but I mean, it does seem like there's a couple possible ways that having bad vision could impact your art positively. I mean, obviously, Impressionists, they paint kind of blurry things. So that's, you know, maybe similar to what they were seeing, which is actually sort of an interesting question. Like, what if it's not even really a stylistic choice? What if it's just what the artist sees, you know?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of it is stylistic, but like a lot of the point of Impressionism is this is like very first year art class, sorry, but just like it's supposed to be a fleeting glance. It's supposed to literally be an impression, like just sort of the first thing you see if you were to slice a moment in time before your brain mm-hmm. had time to fully develop what was happening in it. And it sort of relies on the part of our brain that turns form into something that we can recognize to be able to interpret them, which I think is really cool about Impressionism. And, like, there are a lot of different styles of it. Like, there's pointillism, and then there's just, I'm sorry. I don't know enough about art to talk about this on and on, but, like, there are a lot of styles that go on, like, creating flat areas of color and, like, doing flat areas of color with other colors inside of them, things like that. Just, like, trying to create that fleeting moment of seeing something for the first time. And there are a lot of ways that seeing something in a less defined, less sort of lined way could impact that.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually related to some stuff that I was reading about, which is obviously when the human eye sees the world, when light comes into the eye, it's a 2D image of colors and shapes that we then, with our, you know, stereo vision, interpret as a bunch of 3D objects. And part of doing more realistic art that's often hard for people to learn when they're starting to draw or whatever is being able to ignore the knowledge that your brain gives you of what a 3D object, the space that it occupies in 3D space, and sort of go back to just seeing those 2D forms and shapes and stuff. And so there's been some research, which I believe has not actually been published, but there's been some research into the idea that stereo blindness might help artists be able to see less of the, you know, the 3D world that's actually there and more of the 2D input that represents it in our brains. Mm-hmm. So stereo blindness is a lack of depth perception or less complete depth perception than the average person. And it comes from like having a lazy eye or having misaligned eyes or whatever. And apparently Rembrandt is supposed to have had a lazy eye.
I would have said that if you didn't decide to call me out in front of all of our friends and your mom.
Hey, you could have said it. I have no idea if my mom is still listening, but if she is, hi, hey, mom. Abby's thanks mom. For being here.
No, anyway, continue.
Yeah, so Rembrandt was supposed to have stereo blindness, and according to an article that I read in the American Psychology Association journal, I guess, mm-hmm. the American Psychology Association Monitor, there's some unpublished research which indicates that a higher than average number of art students have stereo blindness. This is not, like, very conclusive research, obviously, but could be true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to take into account. I also ended up finding something that's more about like the sort of interpretive, realistic attempt to create a one-to-one image to 2D image. Uh-huh. Art. The title of the article is Drawing Experts Have Better Visual Memory While Drawing. It's by Florian Pedreau and Patrick Cavanaugh, and it's from 2015. So it posits that artists sort of use chunking to commit loose spatial organizations of visual information into your visual working memory rather than coding an entire image at once into visual working memory. Did that make sense the way that I said it?
Can you explain it a little more?
Okay, yeah. So basically, instead of when you see an image, you can see all the parts of it and like all of the things in it and sort of just try to remember like, oh, that paper's there, the shading's there, etc. Or you can sort of see it as a collection of shapes and the way that they are sort of interacting with one another. Right. And so this suggests that you sort of chunk those shapes together. So there's a specific kind of encoding of memory that's called chunking. And an example of that would be like if you have a long string of numbers, turning those numbers into like four digit meaningful numbers, like 1994. Oh, okay.
That's
so
cool.
Yeah. So in order to sort of describe what they were asking, I think I should describe the study itself first. So a group of 21 adults were brought in for this experiment, which isn't a huge sample size, but you know, it never is. So all of them had normal vision. Three of them were professional artists. The experiment itself basically put a shape on a screen and then changed the image on the screen to a tablet that they were holding in their hands that they were not able to see. They would try to draw the shape on the screen and then it would show them the shape again, but the shape would change slightly. Hmm. So their point of what they were doing was to draw the shape that was currently on the screen, not the original one.
Right.
What this experiment was asking was whether or not the representations of that shape were the whole object that they were looking at or just the part of it that they were in the process of drawing, the part that was changing, and whether or not there was a difference in memory of the original object and of the object that was being drawn at the time. They had earlier split the groups into artists who were, I believe the phrase that they used was skilled artists versus novice artists. And the skilled artists were better at remembering both the new shape and the original shape. So,
yeah, I mean, that makes sense. It's hard to draw specific conclusions about that, or at least it seems that way to me, other than artists have good observation skills.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, I mean, there's clearly a difference in perception. I found a similar sort of thing. This is from the article, Looking at Paintings, Patterns of Eye Movements in Artistically Naive and Sophisticated Participants by Stein Vogt. And this was about how artists look at pictures. They showed them pictures. It was nine psychology students and nine art students, so again, quite small sample size. But she just showed them pictures of various things and used eye tracking to see where they looked in the picture. Artists tended to focus on scan the whole picture, look at everything, whereas the non-artists focused on objects and especially people. So non-artists spent 40% of the time looking at objects, while artists only looked at them 20% of the time.
Hmm.
So yeah, I do feel like regardless of actual physical ability in terms of eyesight, artists are sort of have a more holistic view of images, which makes sense.
Yeah, and it would be interesting to see. If you are specifically an art student, you've probably actually received training, and it would just be interesting to know whether or not there's specific training to work on things like looking at objects holistically.
Right. I mean, I'm sure that's a skill that you have to learn. I mean, I know it is, you know, I'm not good at drawing, but I know that, you know, what you do to draw something realistically is try to look at just the shapes that you're actually seeing and not let your perception of what the 3D object looks like get in the way. So, you know, that's definitely a skill that artists have to work on. And I don't know if there are specific eyesight or brain things that would sort of give you a leg up on that. It seems like maybe there are, but that is kind of hard to separate from just the skills that they learn by practicing and being artists.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really know if there's a good way to separate that. You can certainly ask art students or professional artists to do something in comparison to the general public. But whether you do that or you do your suggestion, or I guess your study did, I'm not,
mm-hmm.
yeah, of trying, like, drawing a thing beforehand and just testing them based off their ability to do that, you know, then you might just have amateurs who have spent a little more time drawing and have learned those skills better.
Right.
But also, you know, maybe people like drawing more if they have more of like a natural ability to do it, which they got from their eyes and or brain. Hard to
yeah,
say.
I will say we treat art very much the way that we treat like math. Like,
right, just the idea that, especially, you know, oh, you're an art person or you have a natural art ability.
Yeah, like you can't practice to learn art or math.
Which is ridiculous.
Yeah, like you can practice to learn anything. You might not be initially very good at it, but that doesn't
that doesn't matter. I was a math major and it's not like, yeah, I enjoyed math as a kid and I was good at it, but by the time I was a senior, that didn't matter because I had spent so much time practicing. You know, the vast majority of my skill came from practice, not from what I knew when I was 10 or whatever.
Yeah.
And absolutely the same thing for art, you know. Artists are good at art because they do it all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, every once in a while, someone will whip out, like, the one example of like a 4-year-old who's painting photorealistic portraits with beautiful lighting, but like that there's a reason why everyone isn't all over them is that it's very weird that
right
that
that's
happened.
Absolutely not the norm.
Yeah, so basically if you are the type of person who wishes that they could draw, you can. Please do.
Right. Please start now. And also, please do math, because it's never too late. You're going to be able to do it. You just have to, like, put some effort in. I feel like there's... I'm not an art student. I don't know how much this is true in art, but I feel like in math, more than in other fields, there's this idea that, you know, if you had to work at it, then it doesn't... Then you're not good. It doesn't count. Like, the people who are math geniuses, like, they never study or do any homework or whatever. They never spend any time on their homework. They never spend any time in class. They just know things. And that's a lie. The best people at math spend hours and hours practicing, and that's why they're the best. And you can also be the best if you try.
I just feel really,
really strongly about people dropping out of math or not doing math because they're not a math person.
Yeah, me too. I mean, let's just real quick pivot into our weekly social justice
soapbox.
But like the people who tend to be most discouraged from doing math are women and like people of color, excluding Asian people. So
yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, I had massive imposter syndrome throughout college, and I was one of the, you know, in many of my higher level math seminars, I was the only woman taking those classes. And I think I was very lucky in that I had a couple really encouraging female professors who sort of took me aside. And, you know, sometimes it was a female professor and then I was the only girl in her class. But I had a couple female professors who took me aside and said, like, you are good at math, you should be a math major. And if I hadn't had that, I wouldn't have done it because I didn't feel like I was good at math. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, women, go into math, please. You can do it. I believe in you.
Yeah. And that if you go into math, it means that you can do cool math experiments. I'm sorry that I don't know much about your major. I should be a more attentive friend.
No, I mean, it's cool. It's fine. Like, you don't have to do math. Math, the other thing is that STEM is not inherently better than other, you know, more female-dominated fields. It is helpful and good and very fun.
And, like, basically what we're saying is all fields are good. Don't let, like, someone telling you you're not good at math or you thinking you're not good at math stop you from doing math.
That, like, everyone thinks that they're bad at math, but mm-hmm. boys are more likely to think, oh, well, I'm, like, fine at math, so I'll be a math major and, like, be in seminars and stuff, and girls think, you know, oh, I got a B, that means that I'm not cut out for this, I'm not a math person, I can't do math more, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's also, like, the whole thing with female role models and how, like, mm-hmm. women growing up tend not to have female math teachers, especially in high school. So, you know, there's a lot going in there. Anyway, this episode was actually about math.
Secretly, so much of my life is about math and
we got all the art kids in here and now we're making them change
and
their
we're just
ways.
Yelling at them about math.
This is an
no, doing
nightmare.
Art is also good.
No, yeah, doing art is also good. Don't let anyone stop you. Follow your dreams.
But also, math is kind of relevant to this discussion, actually, because it made me think about, you know, a huge computer vision problem historically has been getting computers to recognize objects. So basically the exact opposite of the problem humans have, which is, you know, when we try to draw a 2D image, we're trying to divorce it from our sense of the 3D world. Computers have the same sort of visual input that we have of a 2D image, and it's really hard to get them to turn that into a 3D view of the world. But we're getting really good at it because we figured out the math of stereo vision.
Okay, so what are some current applications of that?
I mean, everything.
Well, you know, but
every time your computer, you know, recognizes a face or, you know, a building, a location, it's using this math for computer vision, and it's really cool.
So I mean, Snapchat face swap.
Well, I guess, sure. Trendy and cool. We know what the teens like.
Yes, I was just trying to listen. Also, my engineering roommate did a project on it once, and so I was just excited that I knew, okay?
Yeah, that's actually probably more of, like, I would imagine it's more of, like, a deep learning thing. That tends to be how we recognize really specific patterns, like a human face, is just sort of throw a lot of data at the computer and say, this is what it looks like, figure out how to recognize this in other situations. But there's a lot of different solutions to computer vision. We've gotten really good at it, but it's still a really sort of exciting area of computer science. Yeah, so we got to talk about, on this episode, about art and the humanities. We got to talk about my interest areas of math and computer science. So relevant.
Maybe we should move on to crafting an experiment, because, like, unless you have more research.
No, I'm good. Let's do that.
Okay, cool.
So, Amy, right. Why don't you say something about an experiment? Let's hear what you have to say.
Okay, well, I think that the first thing that we're going to have to figure out is what our objective measure for what good art is going to be.
Yeah, that's hard and bad. I mean, are we talking about, like, realistic art or, like, aesthetic? We can't talk about aesthetically good art because that's not real.
Okay. So the study I was talking about earlier, the way that they separated the artists into two groups was they would put two of the pictures, like, they gave the participants a picture of a house and were like, draw this house. And then they got people on the internet to look at the two houses next to each other, next to the picture of the house, and select which one was more like the picture of the house that was originally given to them. So what if we just did that?
Okay, I mean, that's, like, not a bad idea, but that is still mostly about who's the best at doing realistic drawing and who doesn't have the most objectively beautiful art, you know?
No, I meant, what if we do that with aesthetic art? That would be off the wall and terrible.
Crowdsource.
Yes. Just which one vapes it?
Yeah. For anyone who does not know about which one vapes, check out which one VAP.ES.
It's a really good fun way to kill some time, and you learn a lot time about celebrity culture.
But sure, I guess we could set up a system for objectively judging art based on popularity. We could do that.
Yeah, I mean, this is clearly, like, we're already starting bad, but I think we should roll with it.
I mean, it would be kind of interesting to, like, do that. Do the popularity thing and then do the like realism thing and see if there was a significant difference in the results.
Oh, especially, I like that a lot.
Yeah, yeah. No, especially because, you know, I think a lot of artists start out, you know, especially in school and stuff, start out learning to do realistic art and then maybe branch out from there. So there might be some kind of correlation, but it would be really interesting to see, especially, you know, getting non-artists to do it too.
Yeah, and I also think that it's important for us to acknowledge the fact that the popularity of art is largely subjective and to do with the time that the art is introduced in. For example, like, if you look at art history, you can sort of map out a sine wave of going from very abstract to very precise and realistic over and over again over time.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah, it's really cool. I do think that, like, we should include the art that is just popular and people like.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that would, I don't know how scientifically valid it is, but it sounds like an interesting thing to learn about.
Yeah. Anyway, so that could be how we just, how we figure out who's a good artist in both a mm-hmm. realistic and a purely aesthetic or popular sense. And that's how we can get our test groups.
Right. So then we have to decide, I mean, the sort of easy, boring answer here is then we look at the results of an eye exam on all of these people and see, you know, how their vision is, what eye disorders they have, whatever. I mean, that only accounts for the physical vision part of it. I think, you know, a lot of this is going to be mental, and I don't know how much we want. I don't know what exactly we're looking for here.
Our original question was just, do people with better vision create better art? And should we be looking at color? Should we be looking at form? Should we be looking at precision of vision? Like, should we be seeing how many of these people are 25/20?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if we just got sort of a standard eye exam for all of these people, we could see. I mean, the really interesting thing also about having the public judge this is, I mean, obviously it's tricky if we're using the internet or whatever, but if we could also get some of the vision results of the people who voted, we could see, like, oh, this artist is colorblind and their work is popular among colorblind people, or, you know, whatever. That would be really fun.
Yeah, actually, it would be kind of cool to see what artists colorblind people flock to, if they flock to artists.
Good question.
Oh, I really want to look into that now, but that is not the question we asked, but we it could definitely not. Pick
but
it
I think,
up.
But I think our survey can be that we, ask a bunch of people on the internet or whatever to pick what art they like best, and also, I guess, to pick what art is most realistic, and then we compare those results to various vision exams of the artists who did the art.
Oh, that could be good. We should definitely commission art from them at the time of the exam specifically, just to make sure that
I mean, right, because so many artists have deteriorating vision over time, as do so many people.
And, like, do they wear corrective lenses? Because if they wear corrective lenses, we have to do the testing with those glasses specifically at that time. But, yeah, so we would have to commission art at the time, which I think would be really fun and a good way to use our unlimited funding that we definitely have.
Yeah, no, really fun, definitely. And, I mean, that's, I think so many of these studies that we talked about are, like, you know, we found a few art students because that's all they could get, but if we used our unlimited funding to commission a bunch of awesome artwork, I mean, A, that would be a great use of funding just in general, but also, B, we could get some really good artists and, you know, popular artists, pro artists, just a whole bunch of people. Or we could, you know, pay less well-known and less professional people for their art, which is awesome too.
We would also pay, like, regular people who are not professional artists for their art.
This would cost so much money, but it would be great.
So much. Like, even if we just did minimum wage for each hour that they spent on it.
I don't want to cover materials. Anyway, this is Amy.
Yeah.
Would you like to speculate wildly about the results of this study?
I think that we're going to find some very weird outliers going on here, or some very weird information about people with deteriorating vision who are actually creating more visually appealing art. And by visually appealing, I mean they're going to be the top 10 on which one vape arts. Art.
Which one arts?
Which one art?
I like it.
Thank you. Yeah, do you have any speculation? Do you have any hypotheses?
Yeah, I think there's not going to be a strong correlation between popular art and good vision. I mean, there might be some people who do really photorealistic stuff that the public likes, but, you know, as the Impressionists show, you don't have to have realistic art to have art that people enjoy. So I think that there could be lots of people with bad vision creating good art.
I think that that's definitely something that we are going to find in this very real study. But, you know, before we do this very real study, we have to wonder, like, who's going to fund it?
Jeez, I did not think of an answer for this. Hey, like, Disney? They have lots of money and also pay artists sometimes.
Yeah, they sure do, actually. So yeah, Disney could definitely do it. Also, like, we could start our own Patreon and have people commission art through that Patreon.
Then give them their elaborate commissions.
Yeah, but Patreon could help us. We could really stay with the study of, or stay with the spirit of what we're doing.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Yeah, my idea is more about, like, capitalism and them finding out what art is most commercially appealing, but I prefer your idea of let's, like, get individuals and, you know, the public to fund art, because that's much more in the general spirit of what we want to do here, I think.
Yeah, we had a weird role reversal now. I think that maybe we switched bodies when you started yelling at me.
That far back?
Yep. I just noticed now.
How do we switch back? Do you have to yell at me? I don't want you to yell at me.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe I just have to, like, do some... Maybe we should just get in another fight later.
Okay, let's do it after the end of the podcast.
Yeah.
I think we've done enough fighting on the air.
Hey, we need to thank some people. I'm being you, so now I'm more professional.
Good. Cool.
So we want to thank the Crypts for our music, Marie Curie, from the album Discover Science.
We have a Twitter and an email address and a Tumblr, and they are in that order, @moreresearch_. moreresearchcast@gmail.com and moreresearchrequired.tumblr.com. And you should hit us up at all of those places.
Please do. So I think that's the end of our show, unless you have something very pressing. All right. Well then, until next time, have a Freaky Friday moment with your co-host and stay curious. Give some bad names. Marie, Marie Curie. She's the type of scientist I wanna be. Winning those Nobels left and right. Study pitch blonde and Tober night. Marie Curie. She's the type of scientist I wanna be. Winning those Nobels left and right. Study pitch blonde and Tober night.
Sounds good. Now we have to fix our bodies, I guess.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna have a good time being you, I guess. Gonna hang out in DC, gonna go to some free museums.
You can hang out with the dog.
Oh my gosh, I can hang out with the dog. And you can go to Wawa.
You know, I'm good. I don't need to go to Wawa.
This is why we switched bodies in the first place.
Oh, good. That was it. That's it. That's the non-Amy thing that I need to say to get back in my own body, to get ejected from this body.
We're back. We're back. And I didn't even get to pet the dog.
Aw. Woo!